I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is Cape Up. Sergeant Major Michael Grinston is the highest-ranking enlisted member of the U.S. Army, and he took to Twitter to share a very personal video message about race.
In our Army, we have to trust and understand one another. We have to be willing to tell our stories. Here's part of my story. I was born in 1968. My father was black. My mother was white. When I was three, they divorced and I moved to Alabama. Racial identity is something that I struggle with my entire life. Coming to grips with both sides of my identity, at one point I decided I would put black on the form. And at that time I only had two choices. So I handed the form that I was given to the lady and she said, "That's not funny." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You shouldn't mark that." I said, "Well," I explained to her I was black and white and I didn't have too many choices for anything else on that form. Sometimes in my life I felt like it's in the movie, The Green Book, where the actor gets out of the car and he says, "I'm not black enough for the black people, I'm not white enough for the white people." That's my story.
Hear more of his story right now. Sergeant Major Michael Grinston, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Yes, sir. Thank you for hosting me, and I look forward to the discussion.
So you told CBS Sunday Morning that your driver's license listed you as Caucasian. When you enlisted in 1987, as a result of that, you checked Caucasian. But then you had an opportunity to check that box again. And that's when you checked black and the lady said, "That's not funny." What changed in you, in your life, for you to make that change?
This was one of those things that, you know, I struggled with, you know, my whole life. I mean, you know, because people would always ask, and even in that same interview, people would say, "Well, you know, my, you know, as I travel around and I got older, people would just, you know, walk up and say, 'What are you?'" Which is, like I said in the interview, was probably the worst thing you could say to anybody. And normal response you would get was "human." And then I'd probably say, "What are you?" But I think for me, it was coming to grips with both sides of me and who I was as a person. You know, I was really proud that I felt, you know, proud of both sides of me. And I struggled with that my whole life because there was everybody wanted to put me in the box, whatever box that was. And in my Twitter video, what I said was when I watched the movie Green Book, I really identified with that, the character in there when he said, you know, I'm not black enough for the black people. And I'm not white enough for the white people. So when I checked that block, it was kind of my self-actualization that there are two sides of me and I can be proud of both sides of me.
Sergeant Major, can I get you, cause that was the line and it came at the very end of your Twitter video, which I found very moving. And I would love for you to just to flesh out that line. "I'm not black enough for black people." How were you not black enough?
I'll give you another story then. And this is actually recently. So I was, I'm trying not to, you know, I really don't want to say exactly where I was. I don't want to, you know, make anybody feel upset. But I was, I'll say a year ago, I was leaving an installation. And, you know, there's blocks. I don't, you know, sometimes I don't even know why we have all these racial blocks on the form. Does it really matter? But there was a block. And I said, okay, you know, comfortable with who I am. I checked black. And I was going in the hospital, you know, for a surgery. And it was an African-American female. And she looks at me and she goes, I mean, like, really? And I said, well, my father's just like this. My father is black. My mom is white. What would you like me to put? And this is her words. We'll put other.
Hmm.
So that's what I mean. I can't say it any other way is when you get those looks from everybody, that's the only way I can explain to you what it feels like when, you know, you're not black enough.
So, and that was just a year ago, you said.
Yes.
Now, when you were, the power in that statement for me comes from growing up, you know, Sergeant Major, excuse me, Sergeant Major, I don't know if you realize this, but I'm actually older than you by about a year. And so we're contemporaries. And even growing up, I had those situations where people made it clear to me that they didn't think I was black enough. In growing up, how did that you're not black enough manifest itself for you?
Well, I think earlier, like much earlier, when I was a child, it really didn't manifest too much because my father and my mother divorced when I was very young. And I live with my mother, who is white. And I have a brother and a sister, and I consider them my brother and sister, but they're a half-brother and half-sister, meaning they had a different father, and he was white. So I was the only one that kind of looked like me in my family, in my immediate family. But, you know, I love my brother, I love my sister, and my mom. They all love me unconditionally. I've never felt unwelcomed or anything weird in my immediate family at all. I don't think I really experienced that because we kind of lived in our little neighborhood and it was all white predominantly. And so when you grow up that way, you don't, you know, when you're just a kid, you can't experience that.
Right.
It was as I started to grow a little older where I started to get those experiences where I just didn't fit in any group. And it wouldn't matter which group I went with. At some point, some people would either look at you like you're too dark for this one, and you know why are you here, or you're a little light for this group. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And so, Sergeant Major, on the other half of that equation, you're not white enough for the white people, as you say in your Twitter video. How did that manifest itself? Do you have a story that pointed that out to you?
Well, unfortunately, I have a lot more of those because I told you where I was with my mother and my brother in our neighborhoods. That came to light, you know, like all day, you know, when I was growing up as a child. That was very clear. At some point, you know, I would, you know, meet a girl and met a Caucasian girl. And if their family saw me, it was instantaneous that the person would come up to me the next day and go, you know, I can't hang out and I can't talk to you anymore.
Hmm.
So as I grew up, when I got older, you know, a teenager and, you know, a young man in my 20s, I was deathly afraid of meeting anybody, any parent, thinking that, you know, they would put so much pressure on who I was out with at the time that we would have to break up. So for the longest, I just really didn't want to meet anybody's parents. So, and even just friends, because I was just afraid that, you know, it's like, what are you hanging out with this person who, you know, we don't know what he is, meaning what his race is. So I saw that, and even, you know, growing up in Alabama in middle school, you know, there were still two water fountains, meaning, it was, you know, and somebody one time said, you know, one of those was for the black folks and one's for the white folks, and they didn't have labels anymore, but, it was clear, you know, what they were for. I guess that's so old, but those are the manifestations that I kind of, some of the manifestations that I grew up with.
And so in that story, now I'm now curious, with those two water fountains not labeled, but everyone knew who was meant to go to which water fountain were you expected to drink from?
Well, you know, the good news is it just made me stronger. I'm just who I am. I'd probably go, I just drink from any old water fountain. I don't think they were clearly labeled. But, you know, it was just the, you know, it one that, you know, I don't think everybody went to this one or that one. It was just the theory of it, you know, and the theory of that you were in a school where it actually was segregated at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to be me. I drink from any water fountain I want and let's see what happens from there.
Now, one of the things you also said in that CBS Sunday Morning interview was some of the things you would hear white people say to you, not realizing that you're biracial, but you identify as Black, at least on paper. How do you respond to situations like that when people feel that they are at liberty to bear their racism, their bigotry on their sleeves like that, so openly?
Yeah, like I said in the interview, I'll say it again, I wish I would have been stronger and just really come out and said, you know, don't ever say that again. Don't ever say that to me. And sometimes I didn't, and I'm not proud of that. But I really wish I'd done that better. But what it did give me the opportunity to do is I knew the true people, not the facade that you would put up in public for other folks. I would see what their true beliefs were, and sometimes, or always, that's helpful.
You are the highest ranking enlisted person in the Army. Do I have that right?
Yes.
The military has the reputation of being one of our nation's most egalitarian institutions. But it sounds like that's not exactly the case. Do I have that right? Does the reputation not exactly meet up with the reality?
No, you know, I'm here. I'm in the position today. So I think we are a very diverse group that has led the nation in equality. I think we lead in diversity, but we are a million strong. And I, you know, anytime you have a very large group like that, I wouldn't say that there aren't folks that are, you know, that shouldn't be in our ranks. So we are literally a microcosm of our communities. I like to think we're better, but we're not perfect. And my stories say that we have issues and we have to do better. I think we are doing well in certain areas, but by no means are we perfect. And we need to listen to our folks. We need to actually understand their stories and then take action. That's what I'm trying to say is if we think this is just somebody else's problem and the military isn't dealing with this, that's not true. I think we're doing well, but what I'm trying to say is that we can always do better.
I think one of the things that I found, of course, I found your Twitter video moving in what you had to say, but it was the fact that you felt compelled to say it given your rank. Why did you feel it was so important to speak out on the subject of race?
Well, first of all, you know, our whole nation and our military, and specifically the Army, we're all struggling with this. And I think what I've learned by telling this, my story, was that, other people said, well, I had this issue too. And then we can confront it. When you can see that your leaders are dealing with some of the same things, you go, well, it's okay for me not to internalize it. I can actually come out and talk to my leadership about my feelings. And then that's how we move forward. That's how we move forward as a nation. That's how we move, like I said, we need to do better in the Army. When you can say, well, if he's dealing with this, or she, and they're in the leadership position, then maybe it's okay for me to talk about what I struggle with. And what I hope was we inspired the Army to come out and just kind of talk about our feelings, understand it. And then, like I said, we can do better. But just internalizing it sometimes, and you keep it to yourself, it's going to be hard for us to move forward if we don't deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, the other thing that made your video so powerful, not only because you're the highest ranking enlisted person in the Army, but that somehow I have this impression that you had to get permission to do this. Did you have to clear it with folks in a higher rank than you to put out that 1 minute, I think it was a minute and 15 seconds, 6 second video?
No, I didn't have to clear it. I think what the struggles on my face were internal. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, well, you've heard, how I struggled with this identity, when I was younger, and as I got older, I was comfortable being me. But I think people in life, have struggles internally and how they, but, that was a very personal story to come out. Mm-hmm. And, to share that with the world was something that, I think needed to be said. But it's a very personal story and struggle, and it shouldn't have to be. So I didn't have to clear that with anyone. I just did it, but it wasn't like I was waiting. It was more for me to come out and say, this is who I am. With the military, sometimes we glorify our leaders, put on this pedestal. And to share an intimate, story sometimes isn't, as easy as people think it is.
So, Sergeant Major, were you surprised by the reaction to your video? And I'm also curious, what have you heard from your troops who saw it?
I was surprised. I didn't know how far-reaching this would go. And I didn't understand how people would associate their own stories with mine. And like I said, sometimes, I just go back, not now, but, I'm looking back at my life when I was in my 20s, and I felt like, I'm the only one in the world that's dealing with this right here, right now. And maybe that's why I thought, it was important to share that too. But I had no idea it would reach. There hasn't been a day yet since I made that video. I haven't had either a phone call, an email, or someone yesterday stopped me and just walked up and said, I saw your video and thank you. It really reached out to me. And then I had a friend of mine work together. He's an officer, and he sent me his story. It was a few days ago, about a week, and he sent me an email, and he said that, I'm Korean, and I knew that, but he goes, well, my parents, I was adopted, and, I struggled with that, that two parts of me, because, he went to predominantly, Caucasian schools. His parents were, foster parents were white. But he had this other side of him that, he didn't you know, really understand. And, you know, people said things about him that I thought were terrible, which were things that people said about me, that, you know, so we related in the same story. And he had conversations with his soldiers, too, based off what I had said. So I really didn't see how well this would open up the Army to have this discussion. I didn't see that. I just wanted to share my story and in hopes that other people would be comfortable sharing their stories.
Sergeant Major, could I get you to talk about the conversation that's happening within the military about the Confederate flag, it's being banned, but also the renaming of the bases. From a symbolic perspective, why is it important, or do you think it's important, that that military bases reflect who we are as a country now, as opposed to who we were as a country when those bases were named?
Yeah, and I think that what's important here is, you know, the Secretary of the Army, I trust that is going to do everything appropriate. And that's kind of a question on the renaming the bases, is one of those issues that the Secretary of the Army has already come out and asked for a commission on. And I think that's important for how we can evolve as a country. Or as the military.
And final question to you, and I really do appreciate your taking the time to talk about your video, to talk about the significance and why you felt it was important to tell your story, and as a way of getting others within the military, but I guess around the country, to tell their stories. The moment that we're in right now in this country is fraught, is the only word that comes to mind right now. If you were in front of a high school class right now, talking about this moment, what would you tell those students, those young people, about where we are right now, and why where we are right now is important in terms of being honest and open about who you are?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, in my opinion, and I have two young daughters, so, and my daughter, who just graduated high school, yeah, she was emotional about this. So we've had these conversations. I may have not been in front of a whole high school student body, but I, you know, we've had these conversations with my daughter, and it's emotional. So first of all, it is emotional. We all have to understand that this is emotional. And the reason I say that is if you don't acknowledge that people have strong feelings on this, then you will never be able to listen. So not just hear what people are saying, but actually listen. And it's hard to understand, if you're on either side of this, what the other person is going through. Because you haven't experienced that question, you know. Maybe you've never had anybody walk up and in a store and just go, "What are you?" It's like, so if you've never had that experience, it's hard to sympathize with the other person. So, but understand that. So first it would be, it's a strong emotion. But I'd ask is for people to listen first. And then see through other people's eyes. And that is really difficult. That would be difficult for an adult. I think that would be difficult for high school students, but I think we can do it. Is that we can evolve and get better understanding of who we are. And then lastly, I would say is, especially to the high school, is get to know the people and where they come from and get to know them on a different level. And I think as, especially now with, because we're dealing with other things in the world, maybe we're not even in high school, we're sending texts or we're doing this interview over the phone or we're doing something through virtual means, that social connection is important. And then understanding the complete story that others have around you. And then that way, if you know where they come from, you may not be able to understand exactly what they're going through, but at least you know their story, and then you can maybe try to empathize with them. Because right now, I think the best way to get through this is that we can have a better understanding of each other.
Sergeant Major, I actually lied. I do have one more question, and it's a question that you brought up at the very beginning of this interview, and I wrote it down and then forgot to ask you, but you just brought it up again, and it was in relation to what you were talking about in terms of the hard conversation you were having with your daughters. And that is the question of someone coming up to you and asking this question: what are you? In closing out this interview, talk about why that question is so painful.
Well, it's so painful because it doesn't recognize that people are different. And you can't understand that somebody's different from you. You can't understand why their hair is a little curly or why their skin's a little darker. Or even the question isn't asking your race. You're asking, what are you? You know, that's not a question of what's your race. It's like it questions you as like a human. In other words, you're saying, I'm not a human being. When you say, in my mind, that's what I thought. Well, you don't even recognize me as a human being by asking that question. And that, I know that's not what they meant. I know that. And some people weren't doing it to be mean, but they just didn't understand how to say it. Well, that's even problematic for me too, is then don't say it. Just accept people. Is this a good person, a bad person? You know, but to be bold enough to just walk up and then question whether this person is a human being, to me, it's not being empathetic. It's not being willing to be open. It's not willing to open up to other folks that are different than you are. And then just accept them for who they are. And if they're willing to share their story later, just be thankful that they were willing to do that. But don't immediately think that they're something less than a human.
What is there anything that makes you hopeful about this fraught moment that we're in?
Well, there's a lot of things. First of all, I'm in the Army and I love the Army. And when I look around, I can walk down my hallway and I see, you know, a lot of diversity. I'm being honest, is that we've got a lot of diversity in our headquarters. I do acknowledge that we've never had a, you know, African-American chief of staff in the Army. But, you know, there's several three-star generals that we have female. We have General Richardson out at R North. She's a phenomenal commander. And I worked with her at a previous job at Force Com. So we have a lot of great leaders of all kinds of backgrounds in the military. We're very inclusive. I'm here today because we're inclusive. I mean, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be having this conversation with you if we weren't full of diversity. We're going to get better. And So when I look around, I'm extremely confident that we can do better. And there is a lot of inclusiveness in the military. Again, like I said, we have to do better. And a lot of people are struggling with this. And I think with the leadership that we have, we're going to do this.
Sergeant Major Michael Grinston, thank you very, very much for coming on the podcast and sharing more of your story.
Oh, Jonathan, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.